And welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming here to share these moments, to try to learn about something that is essential for our lives. In our daily life, we usually have goals, but most of our goals have to do with our body, you know, and maybe our minds also, to try to get to a better position physically so that we have a better house or a bigger family. And as a humanity, we have pursuing all this because we think that this is going to give us happiness. Otherwise, we would not spend all the energy and make all the sacrifices that it implies to get these goals, material or in our social position. We spend a lot of energy, we enter in a lot of conflict to accomplish this because we think it's going to bring us happiness. But the truth is that it doesn't. It brings us some happiness here and there, but it never brings us that happiness that is beyond sorrow. So many thinkers in the world, if we can call them thinkers, have discovered that happiness comes from a different place, let's say. And one of the ways that they present this is through the concept of being enlightened. Now, the word enlightenment is a Western world. Obviously, it's an English world, word, and it is used to translate several different Eastern words. For example, in Buddhism, there is a word that is bodhi. Bodhi means knowledge of the true nature of something. And sometimes that word bodhi, B-O-D-H-I, is translated as enlightenment. Then you have in Zen Buddhism, for example, they use the word kensho, K-E-N-S-H-O, which is again the seeing into our true nature. Then you have, for example, in Hinduism, the word jnana, J-N-A-N-A. Jnana. And again, it's the knowledge of the reality of things. So all these different words are translated with the term enlightenment. If you see, there is a common thread in all these definitions. There is the idea of seeing or knowing or understanding. So that means that we don't know or we don't see or we don't understand the true nature of what we are, or life is, or reality is. That means we have a mistaken perception of who we are, for example. And in the Eastern traditions, they say this is the origin of sorrow, the mistaken perception of who we are. It's not the origin of sorrow, it's not that we don't have enough wives, or money, or sons, you know? No, the problem is that we don't have the correct perception of who we really are. So let us see who we are from a point of view of several philosophies, mainly in the East, but also the theosophical traditions agrees with this particular view. The idea is, show more or less the idea from the theosophical tradition. But as I said, you can translate it to other traditions also. But the idea is that there is one universal being, or self, or non-self. We cannot go into that, but the definition of this self is actually a non-self, or neither of them, but let us not go into this. The idea is that there is one single consciousness, which is, again, beyond what we know as consciousness. Consciousness usually means I am aware of something that is separate from me. But this, if there is one single consciousness, there is nothing outside, separate. So it is called consciousness, again, just because we don't have the appropriate word. It is called self, just because we don't have the appropriate word. But let us say there is this one consciousness which becomes several individual beings. So what we have here is a phenomenon like, suppose you have the light that comes from the sun. It's just a homogeneous light that is everywhere. Now, if you get a magnifying glass, you can produce like a sunbeam, like a beam that you can see and distinguish from the rest. Now, this beam is not different from all the light that is around. It's just exactly the same, but because of the effect of the magnifying glass, it looks as if it were separate. And if you have several magnifying glass, you see all these beams that look separate, but they are nothing else but the one light there. So this one universal self that we could call spirit, the universal spirit, becomes all these beams, which is nothing but the spirit, but we call usually soul. So these are individual souls. Now these souls are still very, they still dwell in a place of unity. Now when these souls express through this dense plane, and these souls have to acquire a body, then we come to personal beings, meaning that these souls acquire a body that is obviously separate from the rest. So at the level of the universal, the individual soul, although there is certain individuality, the limit or the differences between the souls is not very marked. There is still a sense of unity. There is a state of I am in unity with the rest. Here, there is a state of I am myself separate from the rest. So from a sense of, let's say, I amness, just an abstract sense of being, I am, I exist, we come to a sense of I am so and so. You know? So, but this, even this sense of I am, I exist, comes from something that Blavatsky called beingness, in the sense of this is not a being, because one being implies that it's separate or different from the rest. This is like the essence that is behind any being. So from this beingness comes the sense of I am, I exist, and then when that sense is expressing through a body, comes the idea of I am Pablo. And when this soul identifies with the body, all the problems begin. Because the soul never dies, but the body does. So when the soul incarnates in the body, there is a fear of death. The soul cannot be harmed, but the body can. Psychologically, the body and the mind, when I say personal beings, is the mind-body complex. So then we are afraid of others, or we have to defend ourselves, or we have to be aggressive to obtain things. The soul doesn't need anything, but we as separate entities do. So if I get something, I'm taking it away from somebody else or from the common pool. So we start getting into conflicts. So the whole problem comes because the soul identifies with the body. The body is an expression of the soul. But people who realize that they are the soul, or even more, that they are just the one universal being, they are not so worried about the body. Because this body is just like a coat. You know, you use a coat, and then when the coat doesn't work anymore, you just, you know, dispose of it. And you don't think twice, supposing that you can obtain another coat. So the same with the soul. The soul doesn't really care much about the body. If the soul retains the memory, the knowledge, that it is beyond the body. So enlightenment is when the consciousness that is expressing through the body realizes that is what we are calling here soul, or even more than that, realizes that is this one being, or call it, different traditions call it in different ways. I'm using terms that are more related to how the theosophical tradition chose to express this. But any words are limited, you know, and you have to choose one way to present it. So some traditions say that this process, remember when I say bodhi, jnana, kensho, all this is the knowledge of the true nature of ourselves, which is, ultimately speaking, this universal being. So there are some traditions that say this perception of who we really are is gradual. We have to work hard to attain this perception. And there are enlightened beings in these traditions that are talking from experience. Now, there are some other traditions that they say it's not gradual, this is sudden. You suddenly realize who you are, and that's it. That's the end of it. And they also have enlightened beings, and they also are talking from experience. So how is it possible that we have these two views that seem to be opposite when they come from enlightened beings? Is it that for some people it's gradual, for some it's sudden, or that the two of them are right, or the two of them are wrong, or what? For example, in Buddhism you have usually a gradual view, but then you have some traditions like Zen Buddhism that has a sudden view. Or in Hinduism you have, again, the gradual view in yoga, not only the Hatha yoga, the yoga of the exercises, the asanas, but the yoga as a philosophy. But then you have Vedanta that has a sudden view, especially the modern Vedanta, not so much the ancient Vedanta. Or even in Tibetan Buddhism, most schools in Tibetan Buddhism, including the Dalai Lama's one, have a gradual view of enlightenment, but then you have Dzogchen that belongs to another tradition that they have this sudden view of the path. So what is the right view? Now, when you see and you study, let's complete this. When you study all this, you can see that we don't really need to become something, because we are this one being through the that is expressing through all these bodies. So you are expressing through everybody, or I, because we are all one. You don't need to become anything. You are already what you are. And that's the end of it. So just be what you are. But the problem is that we still don't know it. You can tell me you are the one being, and I say, okay, what's next? No, nothing is next. You are the one being. But because we don't know it, even though we are the one being, we are not. It's just like there is a beggar that had a block of a rock that he used to have, you know, in his place, where next to the road where he used to sit on and ask for money. Now, he didn't know that this stone was really gold, but it was so dirty that he thought it was a stone. So he was really a very rich man, but he was a beggar because he didn't know that that was gold. So he acted like a beggar and he lived like a beggar. So we may be the one being, but because we don't know it, and because we act as being the separate beings, for all purposes, we are not the one being. And then we are afraid, we are aggressive, we think that we need things, and we act as being a beggar in that sense. So all we have to do is to stop thinking that we are the person, that we are so-and-so. Just stop thinking that, stop believing. Just realize that you are the one being. If you do that, that's it. That's all you have to do. It's a wrong perception. Now, the problem is that we cannot do it. Even though we are the one being, and the only thing that we have to do is to stop thinking that we are the separate person, we cannot do it. Why? There is a habit to regard ourselves as this person. And habits are very strong in consciousness, even very silly habits. When you try to change habits, you see how difficult to change they are. And consciousness, because it has been embodied for so long, if you believe in the theory of reincarnation, it has this natural habit to think itself as separate from the rest, as this individual. So what we have to do is to break that habit. That's the first step. We have to break this normal way of looking at ourselves as being this person. Suppose one day you wake up and you see the reflection in the mirror and it's a completely different person. You are in another body. Do you think that you would just say, oh well, you know, it's just another body and just go with it? Or you would have a strong reaction to it just because we are so used to our image? In meditation, try to imagine yourself, really imagine yourself, as being somebody else with a different gender, maybe a different ethnicity. And you will see how difficult it is. Our consciousness has this self-image that is really strong. So why can't we break this habit? There are two aspects to this. One is that consciousness doesn't realize the situation. It is like, you know, there is a typical example in Hinduism especially. It is a little dark, you enter a room. In India there are snakes everywhere, or especially in the past, you know, there were snakes everywhere. So you enter a room, you see a rope in the corner of the room, and you think it's a snake, and you freak out, as we say. So that is not a snake. And yet, you are having a reaction as if that were a snake. It is a wrong perception, but the fear is very real. So suppose that there is an enlightened being there that knows that the snake is not a snake. Then what this person has to do is first try to convince you that that is not a snake. Now, why do we think it's a snake? This is what, for example, in Hinduism, they call Maya. Maya means illusion. And they say, we all live in an illusion. And they say that the illusion has two powers. The first power is that of veiling the truth. And the second power is that of projecting something that is untrue. So, for example, we enter the room, and because our senses are limited, when we see the rope, we don't see the rope. We don't know what it is. That is the first power, because consciousness itself is omniscient. Consciousness, pure consciousness, can see the truth in anything. But when consciousness is working through senses, then consciousness is limited and can be confused. That's what happens with us. So the first effect of consciousness being identified with the body is that it cannot see the truth anymore. And that is the veiling power. But we don't stop only at saying, oh, what is there? I don't know what it is. Our mind immediately projects the snake onto that rope. So there is the veiling of a reality, and then there is the projection of something onto that. So we don't only don't perceive that we are the one being, but also we project onto the reality that we are this personality. So the first thing that has to happen is that consciousness has to realize the situation. So for example, in the example, a person that knows there, we are very scared, and the person has to employ some technique to help us realize the situation. Suppose, okay, get a long stick and try to move the supposed snake and see that the snake, it doesn't move. Then when you move it, the rope moves and you say, you see, it's moving. And then you have to realize that you are moving it, really. So after a while, after you apply all these techniques that we may call meditation, study, you may realize, okay, that may not be a snake. That may be a rope. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you see the rope, but at least you are open to the possibility. So although we are already the one being, many times we have to do a lot of work to realize what the reality is, because we have a wrong perception. We think, I am Pablo, and somebody comes and tells me, you are not Pablo. And I say, what do you mean by that? I'm Pablo, what are you talking about? Well, maybe that is not the truth. You know, in a dream, we may be dreaming that we are anything, and everything seems very real, and if sometimes in the dream you had the experience of trying to question the reality of dreams, you know, sometimes you say, hey, I think this is a dream. And then you try to test and you say, no, this is real, this is not a dream. Sometimes you realize it is a dream, you know. But because we are in this particular state of consciousness, and somebody comes and says, you are not the body. It's really hard to see it. Just like in a dream, it's really hard to see that it is a dream. So there is a lot of work that we have to do to understand, at least at the intellectual level, what the reality is supposed to be. So we understand that that is not a snake. When the reaction to the snake calms down, then we can see what the snake really is. We can see that it is a rope. But then there are some people, for example, if you have a phobia, you know that it is a rope, and yet you cannot, you know, prevent the reaction to the rope. You react as if it were a snake. And that's also what happens to us. Even after a lot of work, when we understand fully that we are not this personality, there is an irrational identification with the personality. Like if it were a phobia, in a sense. It's something that, yeah, I know I'm not this. I mean, I meditated about this. I have seen several times many things that point out to this reality, and yet I still feel this. So, for example, in the same way that a person that has a phobia has to undergo a certain treatment, we also need to undergo a certain treatment that we call the spiritual path. So all this to realize something that was never there. I mean, all this work just to realize that the snake was never a snake. All this work to realize that we were never a separate person, that we were always one. If a person doesn't have all these limitations, the limitation of, you know, this obscuring of our perception and the natural reaction of consciousness, I could tell you, you are the one being, and then you say, oh yes, and then there is enlightenment. But that is not what happens usually. So the idea is that techniques are necessary only because there is a wrong perception. They are not necessary to produce the reality. You know, many times when we go to the spiritual path, we think we have to generate something. We have to create something that is not there, to become something. And there is a subtle difference here, because, as we are going to see, because the spiritual path is actually to remove the wrong perception, not to try to create something that is not there. We are already the one being. But because we have all this wrong perception, we have to work hard to remove the wrong perception. But techniques never produce the truth. Techniques and practices and may help us remove the wrong perception. Now, for example, the idea is that our consciousness constantly works in association with our body and with our thinking. Right now, I'm speaking. Who is speaking? It's not consciousness that is speaking. Consciousness in the sense of the ultimate consciousness. The mind is speaking. And whatever the mind is saying now, it's saying it as a result of the past, my previous studies and meditations and experiences. And then all that information is in the mind. And the mind is now communicating something. But consciousness is just perceiving. Now, the problem in most of us is that consciousness is identifying with the mind. And we think, I am the thinker. So, for example, when we are identified with the body, let us say, when we are identified with the body, we think we are the actor, the one that acts. You know? When consciousness is identified with the mind, we think we are the thinker. When consciousness is identified with the soul, let's say, then it realizes that it's the witness, the observer. And then it can go even beyond and realize that it's everything. It's the witness, the thinker, the actor, but that is the state of enlightenment. So the idea at this point is that we have to start realizing, retracing the mistake and realizing the truth of what we are. So what we have to start realizing is that we are not the one that acts. Then we have to realize we are not the one that is thinking right now. And as we realize that, we begin to realize we are the witness. We are the observing consciousness. And then we can even transcend that. I'm going to talk about that later on. Now, all this seems to be a very gradual process. So, if this is the case, why are there enlightened beings talking about a sudden process? If this is what actually happens, then, you know, it doesn't make sense that some enlightened beings would talk about a sudden process. Now, the general idea is that there is a gradual preparation, and the actual process of understanding is sudden. For example, suppose you have a room that is dark. It has been dark for generations. People live there, pretty much like in Plato's cave, for generations in this darkness. One of them, one day, finds in the darkness like a hammer. And then later on, he finds something that feels like a glass. So he starts, you know, pounding the glass. And it's a reinforced glass. So, you know, he's hammering and the glass little by little weakens, but doesn't quite break. And he keeps hammering until with the last stroke, the window bursts open and light floods the room. And in an instant, the room that was dark for generations, in an instant, is enlightened, is full of light. So sometimes the experience of enlightenment as being sudden is explained in this way. All the practice is a preparation, but while you are doing the practice, you are still in the dark. You may have ideas that are closer to the reality, but they are only ideas. This practice, this spiritual life, at a certain point, will take you to the point of enlightenment. And then everything becomes clear, just like that, suddenly. Now, this obviously doesn't mean that this can happen without you doing anything. It can happen, the window will break after you have been hammering at the window. Now, when it breaks, the change is sudden. So this is a way that it is explained many times. But there is something much far deeper in this, because even if that is the case, you know, why would you put emphasis on the idea of being sudden? You just put emphasis on the graduality of the process, And then the experience will come suddenly, but what you need to do is a gradual process. Why would you insist, like some of the enlightened masters, in that the process is sudden? And this is very important, because at a certain point, the gradual approach becomes a hindrance, becomes a trap. At a certain point, something different is needed. To understand this, the example that I gave about the window is not appropriate. Suppose that there wasn't a window, there was a big, heavy door. So you start hammering at the hinges until you can break them. Now, at a certain point, you have to stop hammering and remove the door. If you keep hammering, you are not going to go any further. So all the spiritual life takes you to a certain point, but at a certain point, there is the need of changing the direction, changing the approach. Why? And this is where the sudden path is very important. Because who is the one that is practicing? I sit to meditate every morning. Who is sitting there? Is consciousness sitting there? No, it's the mind and the body. So it's the actor and the thinker. The problem that we have right now as pure consciousness is that we think we are the actor and the thinker. It's that identification. If we break that identification, it is finished. But we have this identification and we start going through the spiritual life, doing all these practices that we need to convince the mind that we are not this. But while we are working at this level, we are still believing that we are the thinker, that we are the actor. So as long as I'm acting as being the mind, I am validating that knowledge, that perception. I'm still thinking or acting based on a wrong assumption. So all this previous practice is necessary because we are in this state of panic. We see the snake, we are in a state of panic, and when we are in this state of panic, we have to address the panic first. We have to calm down our minds. We have to produce the ability of being calm. Because, for example, if right now the instruction from the point of view of the sudden path is, you are what you are. Whatever you think you are not. You don't need to become anything, because whatever you become is not you. You are already what you are. So just stop doing. Stop thinking. Stop trying. Stop becoming. Just be. There's nothing you have to attain. There's nothing you have to develop, because you are already the perfect, complete one being. So just stop. Now, can we do it? We cannot do it because the mind and the body are restless. So all the spiritual practice is to bring the mind and the body to generate the purification that is needed for us, or for the mind and the body, to be able to stop. Once the mind and the body stop, then we can realize the truth. We can see what we really are. But if we don't know that the aim is to stop doing, not to do, is to stop doing, we will be the whole time hammering at the hinges, even when they are not there anymore. So the sudden path is important at a stage where we have developed the ability to rest in just being. And then we have to start working on that, because graduality, the gradual path, is only at the level of the mind and the body. When we stop trying, we stop pursuing, we stop becoming, then we are. We are not when we are trying to get something. So that is where the sudden path becomes important. And this is why many enlightened beings have promoted the sudden path, even though they recognize that there is a graduality involved. But you can see how vital it is at the same time to understand that the gradual path will take you only so far. It is necessary, but it is based essentially on a wrong idea, on the idea that you are the body and you are the mind. The one that tries is always a mind. Consciousness never tries. Consciousness is. So at that point, you don't need to try. You don't need to practice. Now, if we don't understand this in the proper context, we may be trying to be when we are just being the mind. You know, we may say, I am what I am, and I don't need to do anything because I'm already perfect. And that is not true. I mean, yes, essentially, you are the one being. But as long as you think that you are the mind and you are the body, you are not that perfect one consciousness. You are still, we are still, deluded by the illusion that we are this. So saying, I am the whole, is very tricky. Who is that I? I am the whole means I am not Pablo. Pablo obviously is not the whole. This body, this mind, obviously are not the whole. So if I say I am the whole, I'm saying I am not Pablo. I am not this body with all its needs. I am not this mind and emotions with all their needs. I am the whole. Of course, if we repeat this without any understanding, then we fall into many traps and we think we don't need anything, and then we fall prey of our psychological needs, and many things may happen. This is why this idea of the sudden path is usually secret. In most traditions, it's kept and is taught only to people who have gone through a long training, who ideally are already in a place where they can understand it. But lately, and by lately I say in the last few decades, this knowledge of the non-dualistic approach has become public, and when it is understood in the wrong concept, it becomes one more trap. So it's very important to understand this and to research it. You don't need to believe me. I'm trying to point something out and then begin to look into this, begin to research, begin to try to look inside and see if this is not true. So how can we work in this direction? There are several ways in which I like maps, you know, that may show generally where we are supposed to go. Well, I shouldn't say that. My mind likes these maps. So that, you know, helps the mind to be quiet. If your mind also likes maps, I can share one with you. There is in Hinduism a description of different states of consciousness. In English, they are the waking state of consciousness, which is the one most of us are here right now, the sleeping or dreaming state of consciousness, then there is the deep sleep state of consciousness, when we are sleeping but nothing is happening in our mind, or so it seems. We are not dreaming. And then they say there is a state that is beyond the three of them. So let me say there is the waking, there is the dreaming, there is the sleeping in the sense of a deep sleep, and there is the state that is beyond. So the waking is when we are related to external objects. We are awake and we are relating to things that are outside of us. So there is a relationship with external objects. In the dreaming state, there is a relationship to internal objects. Our bodies in our bed, and the whole world that is created in our mind. We generate a separation. The dream is all me, and yet I feel that I am this particular part of myself, and that all the other parts of myself is separate from me. That is all the rest of the dream. So we generate that duality anyway, but it's all internal objects. And then the sleeping is the absence of objects. When we are in deep sleep, there is just blankness or silence, or we wake up and we don't remember anything, or we think we don't remember anything. And if somebody asks us, we say, oh, I slept really well. I slept very soundly, very deep, no dreams. We have the feeling that that was something good, but we have the impression that we are unconscious. That's just because how consciousness works. For example, if somebody asks you, go to the lobby and see if there is anybody there. So you go and you don't see anybody, and you come back and report there is nobody there. You actually didn't see somebody. What you are reporting is, yes, I saw that nobody was there. Well, actually, you saw nobody there. There was a sight of nobody there. And that's similar in a sense to the deep sleep, because we are there, but there is nothing there. There are no thoughts, there are no emotions, there are no perceptions. So when we come back, we think that we were not there, because we are used to perceiving things, objects, whether they are external or internal. In the state of deep sleep, there are no objects. So we come back and we say there is no consciousness. No, there was, but we don't know it. We are not used to understanding what this consciousness without an object is. But anyway, that's just a little thing to have an idea of these different states. So these states of consciousness can become a map in the process of realizing who we really are. Because the first two stages are produced by our mind. The first one also by the body, but it's basically a mental perception. If we faint, the body's there, but we don't perceive anything. So waking and dreaming are produced by our minds. And we are identified with that. We are very aware of our mind. Then when we go beyond our mind in the sleeping state, we are not able to perceive anything, because we are so identified with the mind that when the mind is not there, we fall unconscious. So the idea is to become more aware of that state where there are no objects, whether external or internal. So what does it mean in our daily life? It means that we should begin to try to become aware progressively on all these different levels. For example, most of us we think we are aware when we are awake. But we do many things that are mechanical. We probably don't remember how we got here. We don't remember much of the day. If we think of the day back to today, we may not remember many things. So the first thing that we have to begin to try to practice is to retain the self-awareness of the external objects. When I'm living, I try to be aware of my emotions, of my relationship, what I do, not just mechanically, because when we act mechanically, we are sleeping during the waking state. So we want to be awakened on all these different states. So to be awakened during the awakened state means to be aware. So that's the first stage in our practice. Begin to practice to be aware of what you do, to be aware of your body, how the body moves, how listen to yourself talking, how your voice sounds. Be aware of people, be aware of the tree that is out there. You know, begin to be aware of the external objects. As you do that, you begin to develop another ability, which is subtler. And that is to begin to be aware of internal objects, meaning your emotions and your thoughts. So the next stage is to begin to be aware not only of what you do, but of who does it. Not only of the action, but of the thinking and the emotions that generated the action. So you begin to understand the motivation, the mechanical reactions. You begin to see all that. So you have to become aware, awake, in that state that is similar to the dreaming, in the sense that in the state of internal objects. So that is the next goal, if you want to put it in terms of goals. You become aware of the external, and little by little you begin to discover that you are able to become aware of the internal. So now you are aware of thinking, feeling, you see something happens in your daily life and that produces a reaction, and you are aware of that reaction. Maybe your body reacts and your mind, and you are aware of that reaction. And as this awareness begins to be more solid, the awareness itself bring some order in consciousness. But that is not the last step. As you stabilize yourself in that awareness, you begin to acquire the ability to be aware when there is an absence of objects, meaning to be aware in silence, in non-thinking. Most of us cannot just stop thinking, but that is because we have not tread this path. As we become aware of the inner objects, of the motion of our mind and emotions, we begin to dwell little by little beyond the emotions. You can always see and thinking. You can only see what is in front of you. So when consciousness is becoming aware of the external objects, what it's doing is removing to the preview, to the more inner state. That is a state of the mind. When you begin to watch your mind, you are removing yourself to the state of the witness that we were talking about. So as you watch your mind, you begin to discover yourself in the silence. You begin to be able to be instead of always doing. We have this crave for doing because that's the only dimension of ourselves that we perceive. You know, what we call boredom or what we call restlessness is just because we feel that if we don't do, we are not. Because we perceive ourselves only at the level of the activities. But as we watch the external and internal objects, we begin to feel that we are beyond. And as we discover that, we can rest. We can dwell in silence. And then that's what we have to try to stabilize in our lives. We have to try to relate to others and to think and to work, but retaining that awareness that we are beyond, that we are in this silence. And when our consciousness is established there in silence, then the door is open for enlightenment. Then the door is open to go beyond the body-mind complex. Again, there are different levels of enlightenment. For example, you have the concept of body in Buddhism, but there is a particular kind of body that is the Samasambodhi, John? The knowledge of the Buddha when he saw the ultimate reality. Or you have, for example, the idea of jnana in yoga. Jnana is also knowledge of reality, but there is one particular jnana that they call Kaivalya jnana that is the ultimate enlightenment, the ultimate perception of reality. Or in Zen, you have the idea of Kensho, that is this, you know, enlightenment, but they have also the Daigo Tatei, which is the ultimate Kensho. So as you do this, you have these little enlightenments, which are the perceptions that make you realize, that make you take a step forward, makes you realize that you are not this or that you are not that. And at a certain point, the ultimate perception, the ultimate enlightenment will come. But I think that there are many ways of putting this, but this is a way in which we can have a sense of growing into this awareness where we stop doing and we become what we always were. So this is more or less what I wanted to share with you. We can now go into a session of question and answers or comments.
That was a great presentation, Pavel. The question I have is, with sudden enlightenment, it seems like all reports I've heard, it seems very intense. And that intensity sometimes diminishes with time. Do you think that's true with gradual enlightenment?
For example, there is something interesting in Zen. They have two words for enlightenment or for this experience, which is Kensho and Satori. Kensho is the seeing into the true nature of something. Satori is the experience of seeing. It's what comes along with the seeing. Experiences are always transient. Experiences appear and then they will fade away. They will disappear. Anything that begins will finish. The true enlightenment is not a new experience, but it looks like a new experience from a certain point of view for consciousness, but the true enlightenment is the discovery of what we have always been. Sometimes in Zen, they call it the ordinary mind, because the idea is that when you discover who you are, you say, of course, this is what I always was. What was I thinking? You know, kind of. So there are many experiences that come with feelings and thoughts, and those are experiences, that's fine, but they are not necessarily enlightenment. Now, the idea is also that because the mind is the one that is producing all the problems, when the mind stops, there is a sense of peace and happiness. And that enlightenment may come with an intense experience of bliss, but the experience is like the smoke of the flame. You know, the experience may be there or not, the real is the flame. So since there are all these there are all these different levels of enlightenment, you know, usually the ultimate enlightenment is probably something that is very transcendental. But looking for experiences is a trick. Experiences are never the real. So each person sometimes, some minds interpret things with colors or feelings or this or that, and some other minds don't. I don't know how it is with any of you, but sometimes in meditation, if I'm in deep silence, even a feeling of happiness is bothersome. It's, you know, it's something that you say, go away, what are you doing, you know, disturbing this state. So the feelings of bliss, or what is usually called as bliss and all that, may be an obstruction. But, you know, if they come and you let it go. Always remember that is not the reality behind. It's just a smoke around, and that's fine.
We have a question from someone online. The question is, if enlightenment is the realization of our true relationship with ourselves and the universe, and the goal is to just be, what is the ultimate purpose of attaining enlightenment?
What is the purpose of love? No, you love a person. If you really love a person, you are ready to sacrifice yourself for that person. It's very inconvenient. You know, if you are selfish, you get all the money for you. You get all the time for you. But then you love a person, and then you are giving and you are depriving yourself. Why would you do that? What's the purpose in loving? Some things don't have a purpose in the sense that the purpose belongs to the mind. But love is a reality of the universe. It's an aspect of reality, and just is. Enlightenment is just the awareness of the reality of things. When we are not enlightened, we suffer. You know, if you want to put it in terms of process, well, the value of enlightenment is that you get rid of suffering. You get rid of pleasure also. That is the trick. we are hung up to pleasure. There will be in a month in the Living Theosophy a talk on happiness, what happiness really is, and how it changed during history. And today we think happiness is something related to pleasure, and thinking that if you get rid of suffering, you get rid of pleasure, you say, well, I don't want that. But there is something that is far deeper, far more completing than pleasure. As I said, pleasure becomes a disturbance also. So if you want to get rid of suffering, that is the aim of enlightenment. Now, the question may go even a little further, perhaps, and why, if we are just that, we became this, and we have to go back to that. And there is an explanation for this, which is a whole lecture in itself. So, but basically, we could say, just to give an answer, there is a constant process of creating self-awareness in the universe. The unity is always there, but there is no self-awareness. Self-awareness requires a self, a separate self. So in the process of consciousness, of becoming individual self, it begins to develop this self-awareness. At the beginning, it produces the identification with the separate person. But as we purify that self-awareness, it becomes the self-awareness of being the whole. So at the beginning of evolution, consciousness is one, but is, you could say, it's not self-aware of that. At the end, it's always one, because it was always one, but it's self-aware of that. In some religious stories, they say God created the universe as a mirror to know himself, herself, or itself, whatever you like. So there is a process of self-awareness. A baby lives in a state of non-separation. He doesn't know at the beginning that he has a body, that he's separate from the mother, but he's not aware of that. An enlightened being is in the same state, in the sense that he knows he's not the body, but he's aware of that. So the difference is like between the baby and the enlightened being.